And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Visit DirecTV.com. Claim based on total games offered on national and regional sports networks with choice package or higher. Availability of RSNs varies by zip code and package. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
This is the Athletic Baseball Show on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Welcome to the Athletic Baseball Show presented by Topps. Check out Topps Project 70, celebrating 70 years of Topps baseball cards. Derek Riper here with Britt Giroli today. No Keith Law. He is out. He'll be back next week. Britt, you have an important job on this show. You have to convey that you hate everybody's favorite team, and you also have to show us all that you love board games as much as Keith does too. Those are the two main things you have to do while stepping in for him this week.
That's really tough, especially because I don't hate everybody's teams, and I can't remember the last time I played a board game. Other than that, this is going well.
Nailed it. So on this episode, we're going to discuss a prediction that Britt actually made on the other show that we work on together, Rates and Barrels, of course. Britt, you know, Saris and I usually are on every Friday. We're not going to be on today because we're doing this show together. But Britt might be right about the Cardinals. And I think Eno and I held back chuckles a couple weeks ago when Britt said, hey, look out for the Cardinals. They're going to get back into this NL wildcard race. So we're going to dig into how they have done it. We'll take a look at what has gone wrong for the Reds in particular as a team that had the inside track with a really easy schedule down the stretch. Now they're actually third in terms of playoff odds behind the Cardinals and the Padres now. So a pretty bad slide for Cincinnati. We'll dig into some schedule related things and take a look at the rest of the playoff picture. On the AL side, things are getting pretty interesting there where you've got three teams out of the AL East now battling for those last two spots and playoff odds there leveling out. We're also going to get into some of the most surprising seasons that Britt and I have seen in our time covering and analyzing the game. I say covering for Britt because she has covered baseball. I analyze it from a very safe distance, and we've seen some weird stuff, and I think Cedric Mullins is probably the inspiration for that. So we'll dig into some of the more surprising 2021 seasons and take a walk back in time to examine some of the most wild seasons we've seen in the last 10 to 12 years or so. But we begin with the Cardinals. I really don't know how they're doing it. Part of the reason why I think Eno and I were laughing at you, Britt, even if we didn't do it out loud, is that we just didn't see enough talent here for the Cardinals to actually close the gap. And a couple things are going right for them. Paul Goldschmidt looks like peak Paul Goldschmidt again. If you look back over the last 30 days, he's playing like the guy that he was at his peak. They've got Tyler O'Neill doing damage. Tommy Edman is an above-average regular. Edmundo Sosa is probably one of their kind of unsung heroes. He's not playing every single day, but he's playing a lot, and he's playing well. But otherwise, it's mostly run prevention. You know, it's Adam Wainwright pitching like an ace again. The bullpen's really good. And even beyond Wainwright, you don't see a lot of starters here that you would actually fear in a playoff series. I know John Lester's got playoff experience. You know, Jay Happ's one of those kind of crafty veterans who's hung around for a long time. Both of those guys have ERAs north of 5 in the last 30 days. This isn't a group that has top to bottom been excellent, but they've had guys really step up somewhat unexpectedly.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing to me, and I think you guys did laugh out loud, not that I remember it or anything, but definitely think there was some on-air criticism. When you look at the Cardinals, the NL is going to have a team that's just not very good make the playoffs. I think we all are resigned to that. With the Cardinals, as you mentioned, Adam Wainwright, Yadier Molina is playing like a guy who isn't at the end of his career. And I think people kind of sleep a little bit on the defense of the Cardinals. They had a big double play that was pivotal in sweeping the Mets, which was, by the way, the first time that they've, I think, swept a series in New York in like 20 years. You mentioned their bullpen. They are getting back and believe that they're getting back Dakota Hudson. He's going to be a reliever. And Jack, there's some optimism that Jack Flaherty could return in a relief role. So if they do that, Could they sneak in? Absolutely. I mean, I was just in St. Louis last week, and that's all anyone wants to talk about is here comes the cardiac Cardinals again. You know, like that's what they're known for. They're known to pull off these ridiculous streaks. And for anyone who may have forgotten, the last time the Cardinals were a wild card team was 2011. The last time they won the World Series, they were that wild card team in 11. So I think, you know, I covered a wild card team that won it all in 19 in the Nationals. I think it's really easy to say, well, this team just barely made it in. They're not going anywhere. All the Cardinals have to do is get in. All the team has to do is get in and get on a roll. So, to me, looking at the Cardinals, are they a perfect team? No. Are they an NL super team? No. But would it surprise me at all if they grabbed that wild card slot and got hot at the right time? Also, no, they've got a lot of veterans who have been there and done it before. And I think when you get deep into September and you've got all these teams in the wildcard races, having those guys with experience kind of helps. You know, they're not going to panic. They're going to take it game by game. They know that they have a chance at this. And most importantly here, the Padres have given this away. This should have been locked up weeks ago. But because the Padres have all of a sudden not been able to win very many games and they finally won for the first time in a week, on Wednesday night, because of this, we even have a second wild card race. Because otherwise, I don't think we would even be talking about this at all. The whole thing would kind of be locked up. Nobody would really be fighting over this spot. The reason it exists is because of the Padres' failures.
Yeah, they've left the door open by not being the team we expected them to be throughout this season. I think when I look at this Cardinals team, the run prevention aspect of what they've done throughout the season is definitely overlooked by me and probably overlooked by a lot of people. If you use defensive runs saved as a team, they're at 76. They lead the league in defensive runs saved. I think a lot of times I get fixated on teams that are bad defensively, and I don't necessarily pay as much attention to the teams that are very good or elite defensively. But that's one way to offset an offense that doesn't scare you that much. And I think what it's going to come down to for the Cardinals, any team is dangerous enough to win in the postseason. Their experience, obviously, is like an intangible that they can fall back on. They're not going to panic, as you said. They're going to be a team that, if they go down in a series, should they advance past the wild card, if they're down 2-0, they're going to be fine. They're going to be as calm as any team can be down 2-0 in a series. I think with this Cardinals team, it's going to come down to the back end starting pitching. I think that's where I keep having the most issues. We've seen teams successfully bullpen their way out of having enough quality starting pitching, and they might be able to do that too. They might be able to use that script because of the quality that they've piled up. Dakota Hudson coming back does give them one more arm. Giovanni Gallegos, I think, is one of those relievers that if you know you don't play fantasy baseball or you don't follow the Cardinals, you probably don't realize just how good he actually is. You know, Alex Reyes is a good multi-inning weapon. He was closing earlier in the season. Luis Garcia is another nice option. Andrew Miller's a guy that's done it at a high level several times before. Hennessy Cabrera is another key part of their pen. Like, they've got depth. They've got quality and depth in that stable of relievers. So if you look at the group of starters behind Wainwright, Miles Michaelis is a part of that group with Happ and Lester, and Jake Woodford's been picking up innings more recently. I think you need Jack Flaherty to come back and be healthy in the postseason. And if everyone remains healthy in that bullpen, you can make it work. You can have your Michaelis, Happ, and Lester types only go through the lineup twice and pitch four or five innings and immediately kick it over to that group of relievers.
Right. And what we're not talking about is Nolan Arenado has not gotten it going. So could he potentially get it going? And that takes a lot of pressure off of everybody, right? Like, he's not really hitting that well. You mentioned Goldschmidt, who is doing well, who is producing. Arenado has that capability to kind of fire up the offense. If you got both of those guys going well at the same time, and then you look at Wainwright and Molina, and as you mentioned, they got Hudson coming back. The deeper into October they go, the better chance that maybe Flaherty can go a couple innings, right? Maybe he does become like a, maybe gets like a piggyback start kind of thing. Then you kind of think like, ooh, this team's kind of dangerous, right? Like, I wouldn't count them out. And also, if they get to the wild card, in a one game wild card, they're probably throwing Adam Wainwright. And so, do you believe they could win? I do. I think they could beat pretty much anybody with a guy like that on the mound. And one game playoffs are so flip of the coin, right? Like, ball goes through someone's legs. Oops, the better team loses. So, you know, I like the Cardinals. I like what they're doing. Mostly, I like that just this is exciting, right? That we are going to go down to the wire, that we just may see a game 163, which, would be amazing to watch. It'd be really frustrating for the teams and the beat writers who have to deal with that. But seeing as though I'm neither of those, I would selfishly welcome any kind of chaos.
Yeah, chaos is good, as Grant and Hunter were talking about on the Thursday episode of this show. We're all here for the chaos. Chaos breeds great stories. I think as you look beyond the Cardinals in this NL wildcard picture, you mentioned the struggles of the Padres. I mean, this is a team that every time we've talked about them, we've thought maybe this is the time they're going to turn around. It's sort of like the opposite of what's happening with the Giants. Every time we talk about the Giants on Rates and Barrels, it's maybe this is finally the end of the Giants' fairy tale 2021 season. And I think one thing the Giants have done that have helped me buy in is they've been able to get out of a tailspin. The end of August, early part of September, they went through a rough stretch. It looked like they were turning back into a pumpkin. And I think they're showing us that, no, they actually do have the quality and the depth really all over to be a legitimate, not only division winner, but playoff threat. We were talking about the three best teams in the NL on Rates and Barrels. I think it was only last week. And at the time, we said, well, it's the Dodgers and the Brewers in the first two spots, and then we're not really sure if the Giants belong there. I think seeing what we've seen over the last week or 10 days, that's convinced me that the Giants sort of have what it takes to overcome some adversity and to bounce back. Because this is an offense that's now the best offense in the NL in terms of WRC+. So I'm actually in on the Giants as a legitimate top three team in the NL. Maybe I'm too late to the party. Maybe I was too quick to bail in the first place. But they're going to be scary come October as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'm late to the party on them as well. And, you know, I said this earlier in the week on TV. Like, to me, what happened with the Giants is, myself included, nobody really paid attention to them outside of Giants fans in the Bay Area. Then in August, you realize this is not a fluke anymore. We're in August. This team is good. And then you started paying attention and you're like, man, this team is really good. This team is, in my opinion, just as good, if not better, than the Dodgers. They could win more games than they've ever won regular season games in the history of the Giants, and they've had some really good Giants teams. So to me, it's just an interesting juxtaposition, because the Giants are a really fun team, and they are the epitome of what the best kind of team to be around is. And that's a team that wasn't expected to win, that's winning. Those teams are really fun in the clubhouse. Everyone's having fun. Everyone is doing better than they should have done. And then you have the Padres on the other side, which after last year have these expectations, and they've been saddled by them, and they've been weighed down by them, and they haven't been able to live up to those expectations. So I was around San Diego over the weekend, and it's just a totally different vibe from them than the last time I was around them, when they were winning and carefree and they had the swag chain and everything was happening. And the Padres are the worst kind of team to be around, because they're not living up to their expectations. And it, sure, it's been injury and sure, it's been underperformance. But I've heard a lot of chatter about just like vast changes happening in San Diego if they don't make the playoffs this season. I think they have to make some major moves, whether it's coaching, development, personnel. You know, I don't know, but I think when you look at that team, yes, they've had injuries, but there's been injuries everywhere. You know, it's really not an excuse. I think you kind of have to question the methods and what's being done in San Diego, certainly. So to me, the San Diego and San Francisco are just two fascinating case studies of what happens when you have expectations or don't have expectations, and outperforming them or underperforming them, and how different it is to watch these teams. Because San Diego, their body language is bad. They just seem like they expect to lose every game. You know, in LA, Blake Snell leaves in the first inning. You know, then the next day, Paddock goes on the IL, and just seems like all these little injuries that maybe guys play through, or maybe just don't happen to teams that have it going, right? That have that good juju, is happening in San Diego, and they just simply can't get out of their own way. Even if they make the wild card, Derek, I really struggle to see how this team goes deep into the postseason, given all the injuries and how they're currently constructed.
Yeah, I thought for a while that there was actually a chance that playing the most difficult schedule of the teams in the mix for the NL wild card would actually better prepare them for a tough path in the postseason. If you've been playing postseason baseball for a month, you're already in it when the calendar flips to October. Unfortunately, it's been too much of a test for this Padres team. Yeah, injuries are a factor. I mean, Darvish clearly isn't right, and I think there's a lot of recency bias here where people are going to look back and say he started struggling when the sticky stuff crackdown happened, therefore that's the issue. I don't think that's the issue. I think it's health with Darvish. I think we've got a long enough track record of Yu Darvish being a guy that would pitch to like a mid to high threes ERA and a good whip with lots of strikeouts and a little bit of a home run problem to say that's generally who Darvish is. The pitcher he was in the shortened season, that was the best Darvish we'd ever seen over a 60-game stretch, and I think it was unrealistic of people like me to expect him to do that over a full 162. Now, over the first half of this season, he looked like that guy again, so it was easier to start buying in. Like, holy cow, he turned the page. He found something else. I don't think it's that he necessarily lost anything other than health. Now, I realize it's something we're going to probably talk about and debate throughout the offseason, but only having Musgrove and Darvish healthy for the team that went out and got pitching and then got more pitching and then got more pitching, for them to still have issues with starting pitching has to be incredibly frustrating. This party was not supposed to end this quickly. And every time I see Padres Twitter lamenting what's happening right now, I actually feel bad, because I'm a fan of a team that has not had a lot of success over the course of its existence, right? I'm a Brewers fan that is similar to being a Padres fan. Lately, the Brewers have had sustained success. This is new for me as a baseball fan to get to enjoy that. Now, I think with the Padres, this is a team that's still well-positioned for the long haul, but they do have to make the right moves this offseason. And honestly, when I look at their roster, I wonder what it's going to be. It's going to have to be something a little bit out of the ordinary. I mean, they already made the change with the pitching coach. Larry Rothschild is gone. Something's clearly wrong with how they're managing and handling pitching as an organization. Mackenzie Gore is exhibit A for this. If you told me the Padres are going to have problems keeping all their starters healthy back in March, I would have said, well, the good news is they've got Mackenzie Gore, and Mackenzie Gore should pitch at least like a mid-rotation guy pretty soon after he arrives, based on everything everybody who analyzes prospects has ever told us about who he's going to be as a player. And why he isn't the pitcher he's supposed to be, that's a huge question. That's a huge part of the problem. It's a huge part of why San Diego is underperforming overall. Again, like, they've had a few pitching things go right, but they've had a lot more go wrong with that group. And unfortunately, Gore has been part of that.
Yeah, we touched on their development, I feel like, a little bit on Rates and Barrels, but to me, that's like the larger issue for will they continue to be good moving forward. You look at this Padres team, and I also wonder how much of a gut punch it was at the trade deadline to not make that big move, right? Like, you know, I was talking to Manny Machado over the weekend, and he said, you know, we weren't able to do what a lot of people wanted to do. And I think it kind of impacted that clubhouse in there. You hear all the time about, you know, the Blue Jays are a great example. They make a bunch of moves at the deadline. They're kind of on the fringe. It gives their team a shot in the arm, right? They're like, all right, we're going for it. AJ Preller is such an aggressive GM, and we all know they missed out on Max Scherzer. And you could argue that that right there shifted the power of the division, of not even the division, of the, you know, the Dodgers, Padres, Giants, really just kind of distanced San Diego from those other two teams. But you look at what the Padres did, and they didn't make that impact move. And I just wonder how much that really caused these guys who were kind of teetering on the edge anyway to be like, well, doesn't seem like the front office believes in us, or, well, we're just going to sit here and overvalue our prospects, even though we may not be able to develop them. You know, if you ask me, I think if Max Scherzer had ended up in San Diego, this is a totally different discussion we're having. Not only has he won every single start he's had in LA, but he has prevented them from having a bullpen game. They already were having a bullpen game because until recently, they were missing Clayton Kershaw. So what people don't realize is we're not just talking about the 8 wins that Scherzer has gotten on days he started. We're talking about the cumulative effect of saving a pitching staff from having to pitch another bullpen game because Scherzer's consistently going 6, 7, 8 innings. So to me, that's not worth 8 wins. That's probably worth 10 to 12 wins when you look at it. So you cannot convince me that trade, that deal, and certainly giving the Dodgers Trey Turner, who nobody thought they needed, but turns out they really do need, has really distanced the Padres and made them that distant third in the NL West.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, not getting Scherzer was a huge blow for the Padres. And I look at this Padres team, and they have the opposite problem where that bullpen, if they do make it, is going to be exhausted. It's a strength for this team, but when you wear out the bullpen in August and September, it's really difficult to have that core push you through multiple games in the postseason. And I think that's been a lingering concern for a while now. They've had injuries in the bullpen too, to be completely fair, right? Some of the key pieces there, specifically Drew Pomeranz, like, he's a really big part of that bullpen when healthy, a legitimate lockdown guy for the 7th or 8th inning. Not having him, that's a big part of what's hurting them right now too. But I think when I look at the Padres and I say, okay, they got to figure out pitching development. That's part of it. The other thing I look at is I say, Eric Hosmer, like, what are you doing? It was never a good idea to sign him to a contract like that. I know you've covered the Orioles during a significant portion of Chris Davis's time there. And to have a player like that, that just does not fit with years and years left on the deal, I think it's a really difficult decision a team would have to make to say, it's a sunk cost. We're letting him go with several years left. We're going to DFA him and release him. Someone else can go sign him for the league minimum, and we're moving on. But I think the Padres would actually be better off without Eric Hosmer, because if we look at the time he's been in San Diego, he got there in 2018, we add it all up, he's only been worth 0.3 WAR over the last 4 years combined. That is a drain to have playing every day. You need production from first base, right? So unless Eric Hosmer is providing an overwhelming amount of clubhouse leadership and things that you cannot see anywhere in the numbers, I don't think you can keep him around, even though there's still 4 more years left in that deal. I think you need to go out and get someone that can mash to come play first base.
Yeah, I agree. And he kind of seemed at the time like the first big name to come to San Diego, right? Like we're gonna make something here. And I think when you look at it, it was early on seen as like Hosmer's team. And he still is one of the veterans in there. He's won a World Series, right? He's been there. But I think when you aren't able to perform, even if you have some of the clubhouse and you have that leadership, it's tough to lead because you're not that guy anymore, right? Like you're not able to say, hey guys, we need to put it together. We need to step it up when you are not stepping up yourself. So I agree with you. It's going to probably come to a very difficult end here. And obviously San Diego has dangled him before. They've tried to trade, you know, that bad contract for another team's bad contract. I don't see how it ends well, but it is a gaping hole. And especially when you look at San Diego's offense, which has largely disappeared over this really bad stretch over the past month or so, you cannot have that position just be an offensive nothing. You really just can't, the way they're set up.
Yeah, for the season, the Padres have a 96 WRC plus as a team, so 4% worse than a league average offense. They are slugging 398 as a team. 398, that is a huge, huge problem. Eric Hosmer right there with 391. The other guy that's not showing the power I would have expected is Tommy Pham. That's kind of a surprise for me, too. I thought they'd get a bit more from him throughout this season. Even Adam Frazier, who they acquired at the trade deadline, he hasn't been nearly as good as he was in the first half of the season with Pittsburgh. It's been a lot of little things that have gone wrong that have kind of piled up on top of a few big things that the Padres have missed on.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Talking about teams that have disappointed lately, the Reds are sort of avoiding a lot of scorn, I think, outside of Cincinnati because expectations were reasonable for that team. But they looked like for a while like they were going to creep in and they were going to be the biggest threat to the Padres until the Cardinals showed up. And now the Phillies are still hanging around both in this race and actually they're closing in on Atlanta in the NL East. What has gone wrong for the Reds? Like they have had the easiest schedule of the four teams that are still vying for the second wild card spot, and it looks like they're kind of giving it away to St. Louis right now.
I mean, is it possible they just weren't that good of a team, though? See, I never believed in the Reds. They're like that. I know you guys, I think I must crush them early on in the year, but, you know, I think they really hitched themselves to the Joey Votto's having a career year cart and kind of rode that for a while back into it. And all of a sudden we're like, oh, here come the Reds, you know? And they had this really easy schedule and they're not winning. And people are like, well, they have a really easy schedule the rest of the way. Well, they haven't been able to beat really anybody right now. So I don't know how I feel about them. I think it's kind of been a smoke and mirrors act, Eric. It's kind of, you know, I'm not saying that the Cardinals are this 150 win juggernaut, but I look at the Reds and outside of Joey Votto, and I wonder, how do they match up? How?
Well, I think top to bottom, when healthy, they can score plenty of runs. They have not been scoring runs during this recent slide. Last 30 days, they're only better than the Padres offensively. 78 WRC plus. They're hitting 223 with a 288 OBP and slugging 393 in the last 30 days. Votto has continued to hit. Nick Castellanos has been good. I think Jonathan India was part of the reason why I believed in this lineup. Their catchers are actually productive with Barnhart and Tyler Stevenson. Tyler Naquin's quietly had a good year. Winker's been hurt. That's been part of the story for them in the second half. Yeah. The starting pitching there is actually pretty good. Sonny Gray has been bouncing back in a big way. Tyler Malley slowed down a little bit from where he was in the first half. Wade Miley's been good. Luis Castillo looks like typical Castillo. I think they've had a few more bullpen issues than I would have expected. But the fact that the offense is struggling as a group, that's actually pretty surprising for me, given the makeup of that lineup and, of course, the park that they play in.
Well, they've struggled in particular against left-handed starters, and I think there was a stretch recently where they didn't score a run for like 20 innings. So to me, I don't know, that offense, they're playing like the Marlins, and they've got like, you know, I think they have the Nationals left still. They've got like a bunch of teams who are totally out of it. I think they have one of the easiest schedules down the stretch, whereas the Padres, you know, are just taking a beating. They're just facing good team after good team, which is another reason why I just don't think they're going to hold up. The Reds actually should have taken this stretch and kind of run with things, but they just really haven't been able to. And you're right, there is some injuries there, but to me, this team not being able to hit, I'm not really sold on them. If I had to today pick a team that made the NL wild card, it would not be the Reds for me. I don't know, maybe you feel a little bit differently. But even this spring, I talked to a lot of people that were kind of wondering what this Reds team was going to be. And nobody could have predicted the year that Votto had, right? Like, I'm first in line on eating crow on that. Thought he was on the downhill of his career. And to a large extent, it seems like how Joey Votto goes, the Reds go, right? He's kind of the heart of that team. Certainly the veteran there, certainly one of the most popular players in baseball. But to me, this Reds team, what I've seen over the last couple weeks against really inferior opponents, just makes me believe that they've kind of just run out of steam here a little bit.
Yeah, Votto has cooled off over the last 30 days and, you know, was playing at a really high level for most of the late part of July and early part of August. But it's been a lot of Castellanos, maybe a little bit of Eugenio Suarez lately, but he's not the Suarez that he was a few years ago, too. That's been one of the lingering concerns for them just as a team throughout this season. I think if I had to make a call right now, you're on the Cardinals still to win this spot, right?
Yeah, I just look around and I wonder who else wants it, right? Seems like it's hot potato. Nobody wants it.
Yeah, every time this has come up, I think we've tried to give ourselves more opportunities to change our mind this year than ever with the NL wildcard teams. And I've stuck with San Diego every single time. I said, no, they're going to figure it out. They're going to figure it out. Upcoming schedule for the Padres is the most difficult schedule. It's been the case for a few weeks now. 549 winning percentage for their remaining opponents. So San Diego, we're recording this on Thursday afternoon. The Padres' schedule is easily harder than what the Cardinals have. They actually go up against each other in a really big series. This could actually be the winner of this series. I know it doesn't work this way, but the winner of this series might actually get the spot, especially if it's a sweep. Cardinals sweep the Padres, bye-bye Padres. Padres sweep the Cardinals, bye-bye Cardinals. And I realize both teams would not be mathematically eliminated, but it could play out that way. It's in St. Louis, too. So the Cardinals get the home field for that. Saturday's David Freese bobblehead day, so you know the Cardinals aren't losing that game. The Cardinals schedule, though, 3 at home against San Diego this weekend, 4 on the road against the Brewers next week, 4 on the road against an awful Cubs team right now, 3 more at home against the Brewers, and then 3 more at home against the Cubs. So even if the Cardinals go 3-4 against the Brewers, they could go 6-2, 7-1, yeah, they could go 6-1, I should say. I can do math. They could go 6-1 against the Cubs very easily. And if they do enough against San Diego, that puts them probably over the top. So a lot, I think, is riding on this matchup this weekend.
That's a good point. And my issue with San Diego is who's even in the rotation now? They picked up Vince Velasquez. They've got Jake Arrieta. They picked up kind of off the scrap heap. They're taking other people's like discards, which was kind of the old Padres. Right? It's not a team that's trying to compete in the NL West. That's just not really how it works. So the interesting thing with the Brewers there, Derek, is that's like the final week of the season. The Brewers will have locked up the Central. do they rest starters? Do they start, you know, do they start having guys go let? I don't know. Does that change at all for the Brewers? What are they playing for? That last, those, you know, that last three, could they take two of three, the Cardinals, because they are playing for something?
Yeah, I think the other factor for that last week, sometimes the schedule looks like it could get really easy because things are locked up. Other times, home field is still on the line, so teams keep rolling everybody out there because they want to play as many series at home as possible. But I think the gap between the two NL West teams and the Brewers could actually put the Brewers in that spot where they say, yeah, we're gonna rest Corbin Burns. We're going to have him pitch three innings in his last start and make sure he's just on full rest going into that first series. They could do a few things like that. So that series might not be as tough as it looks on paper. That could actually make the schedule even easier. You look at the Padres schedule, you know, they're in a really tough spot. They start with that three-game series on the road against St. Louis. They come back home for three more against the Giants. They've got four against Atlanta. They have three on the road against the Dodgers to close out September, and then their final series of the season on the road in San Francisco. There's nothing easy about that.
No. Like,
not a single thing. And they just haven't shown us enough in the last few weeks for me to stick with them. Like, if they had shown a few more signs of life, I'd say, yeah, this can be Slam Diego. This can be that fun team that a lot of us fell in love with watching in the postseason or throughout last season. But they just don't have that same momentum. They don't have that same feel to them. They don't have that same consistent output that we were accustomed to. And I think they'll still be there. I'm not trying to be an alarmist about this team. I still have a pretty high hope for them for their long-term future. I think they could be a playoff contender again next season and in 2023 if they don't make it this year. But I think I'm finally ready to pivot off of the Padres after probably about a month or so of saying, no, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. I don't think it's going to be okay. I think this schedule is finally going to break them and send them into an off season of some pretty significant adjustments.
Yeah, it's true. And they're just unlucky too. Like, no one's running away with the NL West. The Dodgers and Giants are going to fight it out forever. So whereas the Brewers may not need those games that the Cardinals are playing at the end, you know, the Dodgers and Giants are going to need all those games. So there will not be any of that, like, sit back, relax. Neither of those teams wants to be in a one-game wild card. They want to win the division. So it's just a mixture of really everything for the Padres, right? Injury, underperformance, lack of depth, no real development, potential issues with just that personnel, and then that schedule. It's just nothing has gone their way, and I don't see that changing right now. I just don't.
All right, well, I'll join your Cardinals bandwagon, even though I hate myself for even saying as much, but I just think things are aligned much more favorably for them at this point. The Phillies, to me, I think if they get in, it's because Atlanta collapses in the NL East and they actually pass them and win the division. I don't think it's because they do quite enough to take over this wild card spot. You've been pretty bearish on the Phillies for the better part of the last 2 years. I mean, ever since you joined Rates and Barrels, I think you've had shade for the Phillies. So I don't know if their problems are pretty consistently their own. The bullpen is a little better than it has been in recent years. I think they've got what I would call good enough pitching in the rotation to be a little bit dangerous if they made it to the postseason, but they would be a clear, like, second tier playoff team if they got in, right? There's, again, Dodgers, Brewers, Giants, and then a gap before anybody else that gets into the postseason on the NL side. And I think if the Phillies didn't make the playoffs, I'd say, yeah, that probably makes sense. They probably don't deserve to be in the playoffs.
Yeah, I mean, correct. I have kind of been bearish on the Phillies. I feel like if the Mets didn't exist, the Phillies would be our Mets. The Phillies don't get as much, like, national shade for messing things up because the Mets are in the same division. So we're always like, oh, the Mets. But the Phillies have, like, tried multiple times to go all in. They signed Bryce Harper, who obviously very quietly is having a really good year. And yet they're still just not very good. They'll have this, like, 1 week where they kind of look like, oh, here they come, they're making a run, and then they'll lose, like, three incredibly winnable games. So I just can't figure out who the Phillies are. I don't think they can figure out who the Phillies are on any given day. They're in a really weird position where, you know, they got Dombrowski and they were like, oh, we're not rebuilding anymore, we're going for it again. And I'm just struggling to figure out what, like, the 2-3 year plan is for that organization. I don't see the Phillies making the playoffs. I see the Braves kind of coasting here in a very, very easy NL East. I just don't see the Phillies and the Mets really having that staying power. Also, the Braves get to host the Phillies and the Mets the last week of the season. And I think you know, those are just going to be big games for Atlanta. I just don't see, you know, Atlanta has had a ton of injuries. And early on, we were all talking about how surprised that we were that they were so bad, right? But they have gotten back on track here. They've been able to overcome some of their injuries. And very quietly, they made some really good moves at the trade deadline. So I'm all in on Atlanta, at least in the NL East. I don't know how far they go because I just don't really know what that team is made of and how it would stack up against like a Giants or a Dodgers team over a long series. But I think if you look at Atlanta, to me, they are markedly better than the Mets and the Phillies.
Yeah, there's a gap there for sure. I mean, I think Atlanta could be a little more dangerous than people want to give them credit for in their rotation. I think a Morton, Fried, healthy Ian Anderson trio is a good first three. Morton's been there and done it a few times in the postseason. So I think having that experience from him kind of gives you a little more confidence in the group as a whole. With Fried and Anderson, two guys that are still getting a lot better. And Waskari Noah has been a nice story for them, too. So You go down to those core four, use Tukey as kind of your bulk bridge guy. Their bullpen's a tick better than average for sure. So I think it's really more pitching and defense, but the offense isn't bad either because the core there, you know, it's Freeman, Albies, and Riley, and Dansby Swanson. Travis d'Arnaud's healthy. Even without Ronald Acuna, this is still an offense. It's better than an average offense for me. They did a really good job kind of shopping from the TJ Maxx bin at the trade deadline. Eddie Rosario is a good player when he's playing well. Adam Duvall is not a center fielder, but, you know, is having a nice year. He's kind of a two-win sort of player. And Jorge Soler can do some damage, so you kind of mix and match him with Jock Peterson. They just rebuilt that outfield basically in the span of a couple of days back in July. So that outfield with the core infield they've got, a better group of pitchers when everyone's healthy. Obviously, they miss Mike Soroka, but I think they're one of those teams that people don't talk about that actually can hold their own against those upper-tier NL teams.
Victorinox, the makers of the original Swiss Army knife, have been a reliable companion for life's everyday challenges, mastering functionality, innovation, iconic design, and uncompromising quality with its products. The Victorinox Swiss Army knife provides you with all the things you don't think about until you need it: tweezers, a screwdriver, and even a corkscrew. With the Victorinox Swiss Army Knife, you can be prepared to master everyday life. You can find Victorinox Swiss Army Knives at Dick's Sporting Goods.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie? Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Visit DirecTV.com. High-speed internet service required. Terms and restrictions apply.
We should talk about the AL for just a few minutes, though. I know a lot has been made of Vlad Jr., you know, probably winning a triple crown, but not winning the MVP, which is mind-blowing because if you'd ever told me that in the past, oh yeah, someone's going to win the triple crown, but they're not getting the MVP that year. Like, really? What else could have happened? How could that even be possible? Aside from all that, that playoff race between the Red Sox, the Jays, and the Yankees is much more exciting than we thought it would be even just 2 weeks ago. And part of that is the Yankees not playing well. The Red Sox have been battling lingering COVID issues. They've had a few injuries sprinkled in as well. And the Jays have been on fire. And at last glance, all three of these teams were between about 60 and 70% for playoff odds. So every single game absolutely matters. In terms of schedule, the Red Sox actually have the easiest schedule of the three the rest of the way. So which of those two teams ends up getting in to the postseason?
I feel like it's going to be the Yankees Blue Jays. I selfishly think that would be great. I really like Toronto. They have a lot of really young, exciting players. And to me, once George Springer came back, I feel like it was the start for them, right? They all of a sudden started to get hot. They started to believe. I think that team, to a certain extent, kind of goes as Springer goes. He's been in and out of the lineup, I think, a little bit recently, too. But I like the Blue Jays. And I think if the Blue Jays get to the wild card game, teams will be afraid. The Blue Jays can beat, I feel like, anybody, especially if they continue to play the way they've been playing. I think if it's the Red Sox, Yankees, the Red Sox are kind of limping here a little bit, right? They're struggling. They had the COVID situation, as you mentioned. It seems like the COVID situation has been going on for them for the better part of a month. And I do think that the Red Sox played over their skis to some extent for a good chunk of the season. As you know, I was very bearish on the Red Sox being good as well. Obviously, we'll eat a little crow on that one. But I think at the end of the day, it's going to come down to the Yankees Blue Jays. That's my prediction as it stands right now.
I think the thing that makes the Jays so dangerous, I think we talked about this a little bit on Monday as part of Ken's mailbag, they have a lineup that even when someone is underperforming or when someone's hurt, Springer's been hurt more than he's been healthy in his first year with the team, and they've still been one of the league's most dangerous offenses. They hit plenty of home runs. I love that they don't strike out. And I wonder if the type of build that the Jays have, which is resembles a peak Houston sort of offense. They're built very similarly, right? Do damage, don't strike out. That's the nightmare scenario for any group of pitchers. It's the most difficult matchup for any team that has pitching depth, right? So you think about the Rays and all the things we talked about throughout the last postseason and how their relievers, their bullpen, when you kind of overlay everybody, would look like arms on a clock in some kind of like stop motion where you see arms pointed in every direction. They can give you all these different looks. I think the Jays, as a team that doesn't strike out a lot and a team that has guys with different approaches, is something Eno was really hammering home on Rates and Barrels a week ago. They take different kinds of plate appearances. And I think that would also be a really frustrating sort of granular matchup problem for a team like the Rays. I mean, the Jays-Rays series we just saw this week, if that's a preview of what we're going to see in the postseason, sign me up. Yeah. That'd be a fantastic series to see in October.
Yeah, I agree. I think the Jays are a lot of fun to watch. And I'm glad you brought up Houston because like some of the names have changed. They went through that whole scandal with the cheating. The front office has changed. And guess what? Houston is still good. That team is just talented at every position. That's another team I think could make a sneaky deep run into the postseason here. That's a team that is going to give every team fits because, as you mentioned, they don't strike out a lot. They're offensively a very talented team. Defensively, they're a really good team. Like, they don't have a whole lot of holes. And I know that other teams have stolen a lot of the attention away from them. But really, Houston, in my opinion, is a very, very dangerous team.
Yeah, you start going through what they have in that lineup right now between Kyle Tucker, Yordan Alvarez, Yuli Gurriel, Carlos Correa, Alex Bregman, Jose Altuve, and Michael Brantley. They have seven everyday regulars in that lineup who are at least 25% better than league average hitters so far this season in terms of WRC+. That is absurd. Mm-hmm. Astros-Jays in the AL would be a great matchup too. That could be an ALCS matchup between those two teams. I think if the Rays and Jays meet, it has to be in the ALDS. I think we're in for a fantastic playoffs, regardless of the matchups, unless something weird happens with some of the second NL wildcard teams we talked about earlier. The big hitters that are going to be in the postseason this year are extremely well-built teams that match up with each other in fascinating ways.
They really are. And aren't we contractually obligated to mention the Yankees on every kind of forum? So let's mention the Yankees quickly. Listen, they have like seven guys who can mishit the ball and still hit it out of the ballpark. So they're a really dangerous team too if they can get past that wild card, if they can stay healthy. Obviously, the big keys are going to be Aaron Judge and Giancarlo Stanton who really make that offense go. But people keep saying that like Judge isn't clutch. The guy has contributed, I would want to say, like 90% of their clutch hits. That game in Minnesota the other day, they're down like 5-1. I almost turned it off. And Judge gets that huge home run, and all of a sudden they steal that game. That is the reason the Yankees are still in these kinds of games. They're going to need to win every single Gerrit Cole start. They're going to have to hope and pray that they don't use Gerrit Cole to get into that wild card game so they can line him up for the wild card game. But if that works out, in their favor, and they get past that and they get to a DS, you know what? Don't sleep on the Yankees either.
Yeah, there's a surprising amount of volatility with this Yankees team. And I realize they hit a lot of home runs and they strike out a bit more than teams like the Jays and the Astros. So that's kind of part of what you expect, but it's more extreme even than it should be. I think the point on Cole especially, you need him to pitch in that wild card game and the different combinations we could see in that game. It could be Cole versus Robbie Ray if it's Yankees-Jays. It could be Cole versus Chris Sale if it's Yankees-Red Sox. That's going to be a phenomenal pitching matchup too, and possible tiebreakers could happen, which would complicate things even further. I think the thing with the Red Sox that made me interested in them going back to the beginning of the season, back when I made the famous jabroni pick and suggested that Boston would finish, I think, third in the AL East. It wasn't even, it's not even that outlandish. In hindsight, it seemed outlandish at the time. The reason I believed in them is I thought their offense was going to be consistently above average. And I did think with Chris Sale eventually coming back, some of the problems they had in their rotation would be significantly fixed, right? Everybody would have a much less important role on this team late in the year than they would have early in the year. Nathan Eovaldi has been outstanding. I've been blown away by how good he's been. I think he's another guy that has done it in October before. So you look at Sale and Eovaldi maybe as a nice 1-2 that the Red Sox have, that I didn't necessarily know if they'd have both of those guys healthy at the end of the year because of Evaldi's unfortunate track record of being unable to stay healthy. I think Eduardo Rodriguez has actually pitched better than the results so far. Red Sox fans are angry right now, and they're yelling at me through their headphones. They're like, no, you idiot, he hasn't been that good. The underlying numbers are actually good, even though the results haven't been. Tanner Houck looks like a nice glue guy for them. Hopefully they can ease off of Pivetta a little bit in the postseason, only use him maybe two or three innings at a time. So I do think they're in a better place with their pitching than many people expected them to be looking back at what they had in March.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And like I said, I'll eat crow on that. The Red Sox have had some really pleasant surprises. I just don't know at the end of the day, are they going to beat Toronto? Are they going to beat New York? Are they going to hang on for one of those wild card spots? I kind of have them as the odd man out. But I think if you look at the future of this Red Sox team, they have a really good young core and they're going to be good here for a little while. I think that they're definitely trending up, and they're another team who wasn't really supposed to be good this year. So surprise, it's all sunshine and rainbows when they actually outperform what they're supposed to do.
I'll take the Red Sox and the Jays, not necessarily in that order, as the two wildcard teams. I'll say the Yankees are on the outside looking in, even though I thought Cashman had a good trade deadline. I thought that they made the right kinds of moves. I like some of their young pitching. A good team is not going to make the playoffs in the AL. Which, you know, it's not something we're saying about the NL right now. It just speaks to the difference in the quality of the playoff teams as a group in the two leagues. The easier schedule for Boston, a 468 strength of schedule the rest of the way, also a factor for me in giving them a slight edge over the Yankees, but it's going to be fun to watch down the stretch. One more topic to get to before we go. I was thinking about this because of Cedric Mullins' season. Cedric Mullins has been amazing. If you've watched the Orioles throughout this season, you must really love baseball, and I appreciate you as a legitimate fan of the game if you've been watching the Orioles like every day all year long. But Cedric Mullins' year, Britt, he's closing in on a 30-30 season. He's one home run away entering play on Thursday. He's two stolen bases away. I think there's a very good chance he's going to get it in these final 2 weeks and change. He's hitting .297 with a .363 OBP, a .534 slugging percentage. He's been a five-win player. Might even close in on six by season's end. He doesn't strike out a lot. He draws a decent number of walks and does everything. It looks like he is a home-developed possible star in Baltimore. One of the few really bright spots at the big league level for this team. This is one of the more surprising seasons I think I've ever seen since finishing college and spending countless hours on baseball over the past, 15 years now. And I wanted to ask you, of all the seasons you've covered, what are some of the most memorable, unexpected, pleasant surprise seasons that you've seen?
God, there's been a couple, and it's usually on the teams who weren't supposed to be good. So Cedric Mullins certainly takes the cake, I think, for one of those. Bud Norris won 15 games with the Orioles in 2014, and they would not have won the AL East that year without Bud Norris, which sounds crazy to say, but it's absolutely true. And I know you mentioned Mark Reynolds 1 year, and the Orioles had him too. And I feel like he had some really good years, but because he struck out a lot and couldn't really play the field very well, people were like, oh, it's just Mark Reynolds. But you know, the teams that are not supposed to be good, that are good, always have those guys who you're like, wait, what? You look at the stats at the end of the year, you're like, this guy is really good, you know, and it's just kind of unexpected. I mean, you look at the Nationals, you look at Gerardo Parra, the impact he had for them in 2019, even though his overall stat line is like, whatever. The guy had some of the biggest hits I've ever seen in my life. So it's really what makes this game so fun is, you know, this guy who gets called up or this guy who spent 3 years in Japan or the indie leagues, all of a sudden becomes this huge part of a really good team. And then they usually fall off the face of the earth because everything catches up to them. but you always have those memories of that 1 year. I don't think Cedric Mullins is this like flash in the pan. I think he's a legitimate talent. I think people forgot about Cedric Mullins because he did not develop as quickly as he was supposed to. If you remember, Adam Jones moved off of center field for Cedric Mullins a few years ago, 2018, I want to say my last year in Baltimore, and people kind of assumed, okay, Cedric Mullins, step right in. He's going to be our center fielder of the future. And this guy struggled for a long time until he abandoned switch hitting this year and has really come out in full force. So I think it's important for people to remember, and it's a good lesson, that just because somebody is going to be good right, we think they're going to be good right away, Jarrett Kelnick kind of falls into that box, right? You run them up the flagpole, and if they don't have that immediate success, Carter Kieboom in DC, you kind of give up on them. And very often, guys just develop at their own pace. And that's what we're seeing right now with Cedric Mullins. They always thought this guy was there. It just took him a while to get there. He just took the scenic route. You know what I mean?
Player development is not linear. It's something that I've talked about for years now, where you can't expect guys to always figure it out right away. There's all sorts of things that can cause development to slow down. Cedric Mullins gave up switch hitting. And I think switch hitting is one of the most difficult things to do in sports. It's hard enough to hit big league pitching with one approach, hitting from one side of the plate right now. To try and do that from both sides, borderline impossible in today's game. So I think that was probably part of why I didn't necessarily see the Mullins thing coming. I didn't properly account for the impact that could have. Obviously, there's more to his game than just that. But I don't think this is a Mark Reynolds situation necessarily. I think Mullins is going to be a great player in the big leagues for a long time. That's not to say Reynolds didn't have a good career. He almost hit 300 home runs. Like, he narrowly missed that over the course of his time. 298 career home runs, probably like 10 years too early for the start of his career. If he came into the big leagues now, people would talk about how much he barrels the ball and not as much about how much he strikes out. And a 44-24 season from Reynolds back in 2009 was the season I was thinking of. Like, where did that come from? How did he do that? How could he ever do that again? That's probably the weirdest one that I've ever seen. You know, in some ways, the Jacoby Ellsbury 2011 season, it didn't seem like it necessarily at the time, but he hit 32 homers and stole 39 bases that season. That one kind of caught everybody off guard as a season that we didn't really see all of those things happening at once for him. I would say maybe the Ben Zobrist 2009 season, where he was almost a 9-win player moving all over the place. That was incredible. And Zobrist had plenty of good years after that. But of course, he didn't have any other seasons that would stack up among the very best of the past decade or so, like that one that he had in 09.
Yeah, no, I think it's fun to go back and look at those random years and see who's the outlier and who really was just a late bloomer and someone that was going to become. I remember with Zobrist, I covered him in 08, and one of the big things that he talked about was just the mindset shift of talking to Rocco Baldelli, who was a player, is now the Twins manager. And Rocco was like, every time I hit, I swing as hard as I can. And Ben Zobrist like had no idea that that was a thing. So he was just trying to like, you know, hit singles. And so he just changed his mindset. He revamped some of his swing to reflect that. And all of a sudden he went out and he was like Zorilla that year. You know, that's what Joe Madden called him, you know, and it was amazing to see with some of these guys. And Zobrist, obviously a huge part of the Cubs team that won the World Series and really had a nice career for a guy who seemed very fringy for a while. He seemed like a light hitting utility guy. If you look at some of his years, and he put together some really impressive years.
I've got one other one to throw out there that this one stands out as a one-hit wonder for sure. But 2012, Chase Headley, just over 7 WAR, according to Fangraphs. 31 homers, 17 steals that year, drove in 115, scored 95. He hit .286 with a .376 OBP that year and slugged .498. It's actually almost a top 50 season from the last like dozen years.
Was he with San Diego?
It was a San Diego year,
okay,
yep.
That's why. Yeah, nobody really paid attention to what was going on out there.
Yeah, was not a good Padres team, if I recall correctly.
Wow, that's a good one. It's a good one, Derek.
I mean, that one came out of nowhere. But again, I just thought this was kind of a fun exercise, since Mullins' year was one that I don't think anybody saw coming. No matter how much you liked him coming into the season, a possible 30-30 year wasn't where you were setting up the ceiling. We need to go. Before we go, I should say, you can get 50% off a subscription to The Athletic at theathletic.com/baseballshow. That gets you everything we write. Everything that Britt writes, everything that Eno writes, everything that Keith writes, Jason Stark, Ken Rosenthal, everybody you want to read, all for one low price. 50% off at theathletic.com /baseballshow. If you're enjoying this show on a platform that allows you to rate and review it, please take a moment to do that. And if you're a subscriber to The Athletic, we do have bonus episodes that pop up on The Athletic app from time to time, or you can subscribe to The Athletic Audio Plus on Apple Podcasts. So be sure to check that out if you'd like to get every possible episode that we do. On Twitter, she's at @Britt_Giroli. I am at Derek Van Riper. If you enjoyed today's pod, you should check out Rates and Barrels every Friday. Britt joins Eno Saris and I on that show. We also have episodes every Monday and Wednesday. And this year, during the postseason, we're going to have episodes 5 days a week, every weekday, starting Monday, October 4th, breaking down all of the playoff action. The Athletic Baseball Show returns with Ken's Mailbag on Monday. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for listening.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.